You're listening to the GNU World Order, Episode 9, Season 13. For 2019, hold on, let me consult my chart of Julian date calendars. Non-leap year, 055. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, your friendly host, or at least I strive to be. Friendly, that is. I generally am your host. 13-9. Okay, so I'm looking at my notes here. Listener feedback, flat pack, commentary, and some more of the T items from the A package set of Slackware. Okay, so that's that. Let's jump in. I'm recording this episode a little bit in advance, so I'm doing some listener feedback this is actually a little bit late, really, in terms of responding to this listener feedback. And yet, if you have then emailed me since last week, I'm already recording it, so you won't be answered until later. So that's just be tolerant of offsets is all I'm saying. So this one's from Ronald. Ronald says, "I recently discovered your podcast, and it's become my favorite Linux podcast. So thank you for your efforts." Well, you're welcome, Ronald. And thanks for calling me your favorite Linux podcast. I am truly, truly honored, because there are a lot of good ones out there, and I don't know if this should be your favorite, but maybe you'll find some better ones later, so I'm not going to hold you to this. "May I make a suggestion?" he says. "The audio is a bit quiet compared to other podcasts, and the coffee break music is quite a bit louder than the voice. Could you mix it so that your voice is louder and matches the coffee break music? Also, date formats for shows. I have no opinion other than the year should always go first. Make dates sortable when exported. ISO 8669 ? Date format is always preferable." Well, how can it be always preferable if you don't know the ISO number? I get your meaning, though. "I realize that exporting the date field isn't a likely scenario in this case, but it is. It's a good habit." Yeah, no, I agree. And he says, "As a Canadian, where we're supposed to use day, month, year, but our American neighbors use month, day, year, the ISO format saves a lot of confusion. It's a significant issue." I absolutely agree, Ronald. I grew up in the USA and was very used to month, day, year. Never really thought about it, to be honest. I shouldn't say I never thought about it. I started to think about it once I got serious into computers. And anytime you start using dates in computing, you realize how horrible having to deal with a calendar really is, and how silly it is to sort things by month or day, rather than first by year. So what Ronald is saying here, I completely agree. But being in New Zealand, where they do use, day, month, year, tends to confuse me a little bit, because the place where I work, a lot of the people there are in the U.S., and so they use month, day, year. And it's very confusing, because I felt like I was just getting the hang of really switching over the New Zealand format, arguably more correct format, day, month, year. Day, month, year. Oh, geez. And then suddenly now I have to remember the other format as well, and it just gets so confusing, and it's really annoying. And honestly, it's a format, it's so obvious that it should not be month, day, year. That is so arbitrary, really. Really, really arbitrary. I mean, I guess it's not arbitrary, is it? Like, if the context of your daily life is, okay, well, what? No, it's still arbitrary, isn't it? Yeah, it's still arbitrary. Sorry. Anyway, as to the more important point of this email, Ronald says that my mixing's all over the place and it needs to be stabilized. Okay, well, I've taken measures to correct that as of the previous episode. So in 13.8, I'm running everything. Well, I've always been running it through a compressor, which is the way that I'm using it is to take sounds that are lower and raise them up closer to the higher sounds. So I'm not actually using it as a compressor, but yeah, so I've been doing that. But lately now I am running it through an equalizer and then through a limiter. So hopefully between normalizing, equalizing, and then of course limiting, hopefully the levels you should find are more stable and hopefully approximate the coffee break music. Now, the coffee break music should be loud. It's not meant to lull you into complacency. It is an alarm. to motivate you to go get coffee. So that ought to be loud. But whether my voice should be quiet or not is probably a completely different. That's probably, yeah, it's arguable that that part's probably pretty important. If nothing else, just for the fact that the voice goes on for like 40 and 50 minutes per episode, and the coffee break only lasts about 30 seconds. So, okay, so hopefully I fixed that, but you'll have to give me feedback on this, Ronald and others, because my podcast listening is, it's very structured, and it tends to revolve around mundane tasks, which rarely in my remote working from home, my mundane tasks do not involve a lot of external noise usually. So levels of podcasts for me tend to all be pretty much fine. Like, I have no complaints. They're all fine. Would that be different if I was working some previous job near a server room where there were bunches of fans and stuff? Or in a kitchen where there were washing, what are they called, dishwashers going off and stuff like that? Yeah, probably not. So right now, though, my point of reference is pretty much useless to you. So give me feedback about the levels. Let me know if this is better, if this is not any better, if it's getting better, whatever. Let me know. I don't have a fancy microphone setup, just so that everyone knows. I record on a headset, the Plantronics, I think DSP-26 or something like that. That's it. It was $49 literally at a Radio Shack 7 years ago, or 8 years ago, or possibly 9 years ago now. It was right when I got to Pittsburgh, so that was probably about 9 years ago now. So yeah, it's not super great audio setup, but I refuse to spend money on podcasting, and so... because I don't want to have to ask for support, right? So I'm not spending any money on it. If I ever get serious about podcasting, I may invest in a better microphone or something like that. But for now, while I'm still kind of feeling it out, I'm just kind of using this little USB headset mic, and I'm doing what I can in post. So let me know how it's responding. I am eager to make it better for you, and I appreciate the feedback. Just keep in mind that I'm not doing a bunch of pre-processing. I don't have a bunch of equipment that is going to take my voice and normalize it and stabilize it and then record it. You know, this is all, it's me into Audacity and then a couple of adjustments before export. So that's the setup. We'll see how it goes. Let me know how this sounds. So I've been looking, as you know, probably, at a couple of different technologies. One was Flatpak, one was AppImage, and one has been Snap. I think Snap or Snappy, I forget which one it was. But these are the kind of, you know, it's interesting, I'm not even sure how they're billing themselves now, but they're, I guess what we can call them is application delivery systems. And I have been a fan of AppImage and remain a fan of AppImage because it is the self-contained solution. And I urgently, urgently, vehemently believe that that's an important technology to have available to us. If for no other reason than because other operating systems have it available to them, and Linux should not simply not have that available. But more significantly, because sometimes that's what you need. As I've said in the past, there are occasions where you are in a place where you do not have network access. One person has something on their computer, an application on their computer, that you want on your computer. And the only viable way to get the thing from one to the other is send me the file. And if you can't do that on Linux, then I think that's a huge disservice to users. I think that not being a possibility is shameful, is what I'll call it. So AppImage provides that, and that's very, very useful, very, very cool, very, very exciting. And I've been using AppImage for lots of different applications, and I have no complaints. Little tiny things here and there, Little things like, this application, when I go to save a document, it doesn't take me to my home directory. It takes me to, I don't know, to the root directory of my computer or something like that. It's like some minor thing here or there, maybe I've noticed in some instances, and I it's not even enough for me to have tracked when I saw that, or even track whether it was just something, that was happening then because of what I'd chosen previously. I don't know, so I'm not sure. But App Image is fantastic. It truly, truly is. I'm a huge fan. And yet, app images are big. They really are. They're big things because they bundle. I mean, the policy is this thing is a self-contained application, and so it bundles a lot of stuff into it, and that means that it's a big download. And darn it, if as a Linux geek, I have the luxury of installing something that is nearly, well, let's say 100 megabytes versus something that is 300 megabytes, then I'm going to take the 100 megabyte install. 100 megabytes, you say? That sounds really big for a Linux install. Well, yes, it does. And the reason I chose that number was because Flatpaks also exist. So Flatpak is the other, and Snap. Snap and Flatpak are these other systems of delivering applications. And in principle, they're similar. They're in implementation, they're different. And so they have these library sets that you can install to give yourself a kind of a typical layer of libraries and support files and so on. And then upon those layers, you install applications that you want to install. And these applications run more or less in a containerized environment. And that's not, I mean, I'm not saying they're a true container, but they're somewhat cordoned off from the rest of your computer, and they do this because they have these base layers of support files, these kits. So for instance, if you're installing, I don't know, let's say Events, which I think is a PDF viewer for GNOME, I think. Let's pretend like you wanted to install that for some reason. Maybe that's some killer feature that you want. So you want to install that. So you tell Flatpak, let's say, to install that, and then it would install the GNOME kit or the GNOME support kit or something like that at the base layer, and you'd get that. And then maybe you'd get like a some other layer, and then you'd get the events layer that you needed, like maybe GNOME, and then yeah. Well, who cares? It's an example. So that's. And then you have this nice tidy little events install within Flatpak. And that's been working out great. And then I had the occasion recently to try out Snap from Ubuntu on Fedora, no less. I needed a PDF editor called PDFTK for some stuff that I was doing at work. And PDFTK, for whatever reason, has dropped off the map on Fedora. Now, PDFTK has. There are alternatives to PDFTK. One called PDF Stapler, it's pretty good. Doesn't do everything that PDFTK can do. There are some missing functionalities there. So I needed PDFTK very specifically. Turns out that someone packaged it for Snap. And I thought, well, if this is if ever I needed an excuse to try this thing, now's a good time. So I installed the Snap subsystem. Now Snap is a little bit different from Flatpak because it requires that a little Snap daemon is running in the background. And that seems a little bit strange because I am not thinking, well, I don't really feel like I should have a daemon running in the background just for just because I installed an app. Like, how's that? So I'm always gonna have to have this daemon running just because I one time installed PDFTK. That just seems a little bit strange to me, but functionally, I have to admit, it's completely invisible. I have no clue that it's running. I don't care. It's never gotten in the way. Who cares? So I installed Snap and installed the PDFTK Snap. Had a couple of bumps along the way, but I can't commit to whether it was something with Snap or something with some instruction that I failed to follow correctly. I'm not 100% clear, so I'm not gonna. I don't want to talk about what that was and then how to correct it because I'm not clear on whether it was actually a Snap thing or just a me not understanding how Snap was going to work. Because I did, I went into Snap very much with a lot of preconceptions of how it was going to work based around Flatpak. because I thought, well, Flatpak and Snap, they're basically the same thing, right? Well, no, of course not. So, long story short, PDF TK is now running on my Fedora laptop through the Snap subsystem. And I gotta say, that kind of sold me on the idea. I was very skeptical because I thought, well, Snap sounds like it's really implementing a lot of stuff that was going on with Flatpak. And I guess I still kind of feel that way in a way, because I feel, couldn't we just maybe just have one or the other and not have both? Because one of the appeals of Flatpak and Snap is that, in theory, third-party developers who have no investment in Linux whatsoever don't want to get involved with 130 different types of packaging formats, can just deliver to Flatpak, or I mean Snap, or both now, too. Rather than just have one target, right? But whatever. Point being, Snap seems pretty solid so far. I've been using PDFTK certainly at least weekly, to say the least, and it works quite well. No unpleasant surprises. It's been working quite well. Now, one thing I'm going to mention here is something that I noticed on Flatpak, which I guess you could call a critique, and that is that Flatpak, in a way, removes the simplicity of launching an application in some cases. I very frequently, for instance, launch GIMP from a terminal, because a lot of times I'll be in a terminal and I'll be looking for a file that I need to edit or whatever, and then I'll find it, and so I'll just do GIMP and then that file name, and it opens, and we're off editing graphics. Very, very simple, kind of what I've come to expect on Linux. Now, Flatpak runs applications sort of within the Flatpak system, and so in order to get GIMP to launch from a terminal with Flatpak, you have to type flatpak run org.gimp.gimp and then the path to the file that you want to edit. That's pretty clunky if you're used to GIMP file and then you have to adjust to flatpak run name of repository item file. That's really clunky. I'm hoping, and I'm assuming, I guess, I hope, that they're working on a graceful solution to that, because that's really tough, especially since org.gimp.gimp happens to be kind of peculiar. So first of all, I would actually have to know what repository I got an application from, which I don't know why someone would be expected to know that. I mean, not, you know, you if you only have two flatpaks, maybe you'll remember it. But assuming that you don't, then is that really a reasonable expectation? So flatpak run org.gimp.gimp is further compounded, the complexity is further compounded by the fact that it just so happens that the GIMP repository, the flatpak repository for GIMP, is org.lowercase.gimp.allcapitalgimp, or org.allcapitalgimp.lowercase.gimp. So, and I don't remember which one, and this is a thing that I'm, this is kind of one of the things that made me mention this, because there's just no way for me to remember which way it goes. So it looks like I've just tried to launch, no, I don't think, yeah, okay, so I did get it right. So it's org.gimp.capital G, capital I, capital M, capital B. So it's org.gimp.biggimp. That's the correct way. But if you forget that and you think, okay, well, what is it? Is it org.capitalgimp.lowergimp, or is it org.capitalgimp.capitalgimp? Very difficult to remember the order of that particular repository, at least for me. And I don't know why that is. Now, the obvious solution that you're probably thinking is, well, you ought to just do an alias, right? So you alias lowercase GIMP equals, and then flatpak run org.gimp.capital GIMP, and then that, from now on, if I do GIMP and then some path to a file, then that works. So that's the obvious way to do it. And indeed, it's in theory what I would do. I don't do it specifically because I want to be aware of the fact that I'm running a flatpak, and this is the repository. I kind of want to just remember that's, I want to have an excuse to interface with flatpak sometimes. So I don't alias it. At least I haven't yet. I may eventually, but for now I have not. So GIMP alias, that would work. That would work fine. The other solution that I thought of, as I was just sort of mentally ruminating over this, I thought, well, on macOS, you cannot open, you can't launch packages directly either, or applications directly either. I mean, not GUI ones anyway. If you had typed, I guess, well, maybe it would work for GIMP because that launches the X11 system. But let's say that you are using, I don't know, some Mac application. Let's call it Fun Sparkle app. So if you're using Fun Sparkle app, then you wouldn't be able to just type in Fun Sparkle app. You would have to type in open and then dash A, I think, for application. I'm not sure. Or app or something like that, dash A, and then Fun Sparkle app. Now it knows to look in, it knows to look, it has a path, it has a sense of a path, so it knows to look in slash applications or wherever the applications are kept now on macOS. I haven't used it in too long to know where they've put things now, but you do have to preface it with open dash A, and that always used to annoy me when I was just learning Linux way, way back. Or it wasn't even Linux yet, I was learning Unix. And so, and I've been told, like everyone is, macOS is a great Unix platform. You can learn Unix on this thing. I mean, it's not untrue, I guess. Well, I mean, it's not untrue that you can learn some Unix on a macOS platform. Whether or not it's a great Unix platform, that is debatable. But it used to always annoy me because I'd learn all these cool tricks on Unix, and then I'd try it on the, with things that I used every day, and nothing would ever work, and I didn't understand, really, that. That Unix doesn't mean that everything's going to work the same way. It just means that everything's got a common sort of structure to it. So, open dash A. I'm just wondering if Flatpak run our open dash A? I mean, I can't believe that we're going to keep the org.gimp.gimp syntax. That's pretty bad. That's pretty ugly. But it's kind of interesting that the Flatpak run thing is a thing that you have to remember if you're using Flatpak right now anyway. And you don't see that if you're just using it on a normal, like the kind of the way that you think you should use it, which is you go to your K menu or your Start menu or your GNOME menu or whatever it is, and you find the application listed there and you click on it. Of course, in the desktop file that populates an application menu, the exec line is flatpak run org.gimp.capitalgimp. But again, you don't see it because you're just clicking an icon and it's going, and that's fine. But yeah, if you're doing stuff from a terminal, that's a problem. And I'm not sure that I love the idea that I have to preface stuff with flatpak run. And I'm not sure if I love the idea that I'm gonna have to alias things if I don't want to do that. I guess I could see a future where Flatpak makes the alias itself. I'm not sure if that's the best way to implement it, but I guess it could be a thing, like a post-install, hey, add this to my bash aliases. And either way, Snap doesn't do that. And Snap, when I installed PDFTK, when I launched PDFTK from a terminal, which is the only way you can launch it, it's a command, it's not a GUI application. When I launched PDFTK, it's not snap run PDFTK and then all the different options. It is simply PDFTK. So, yeah, it's just something to be aware of that Flatpak has a little bit of some quirky syntax right now, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes. I'm not sure if there's a right or a wrong answer, really. I mean, other than getting rid of the org.gimp.gimp thing, it obviously needs to have an application name, but in terms of how that command actually gets implemented, I'm not sure if there's a right or a wrong way. It'll just be interesting to see how it develops. And either way, be aware of it. If you're using Flatpak, the syntax to run a Flatpak once it's installed directly from a terminal is Flatpak space run space and then the name of whatever Flatpak sees that application as. If you don't know, if you're not sure, then you can do a Flatpak space list to see what is installed. So this is a little bit confusing too. So Flatpak list, as I said. So I've got org.gimp.gimp, I've got org.olive.videoeditor.olive, I've got org.freedesktop.platform.gl.nvidia, I've got org.freedesktop.platform. So a bunch of platforms, in other words. And those are marked in the options as a system comma runtime. The actual runnable applications, org.gimp.gimp and org.olive video editor.olive, are marked as system comma current. System comma current, it does not say to me it's an executable, so that's a little bit strange as well. But it turns out that if I do a flatpak run org.olive video editor.olive with a capital O, then it does indeed launch the little alpha video editor called Olive. And same with GIMP. Now, if I tried to do any of those things with anything marked as a runtime, it would not function like I would expect. So for instance, here's a org.freedesktop.platform run org.freedesktop.platform with a capital B dot ffmpeg. If I try that, it tells me app/org.freedesktop.platform.ffmpeg/x86-64-master not installed. So that's a little bit confusing because you think, how do I launch this thing? Well, apparently it's not an executable, it's a runtime. It's a runtime. The executables are marked apparently as a system comma current, whatever that means. So again, just something to be aware of. It's something that will probably get ironed out eventually, I imagine. I don't imagine they intend for that to be a permanent thing. Although maybe they do. Maybe they are seeing Flatpak as an icon only, you know, a clickable only sort of interface. Like, that's what they intend. I'm not sure. And I didn't do any research to find out what their roadmap was. I'm just observing that that's something that I've experienced lately. So if you're playing around with Flatpak as I am, then that's something to be aware of. That in order to launch something directly, you need the whole repository name. And if you don't want to do that, break out the aliases. Time for coffee. Let's get some. This is just the store brand, or not the store brand, but like off-the-shelf Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee is what I'm drinking right now. I will say that I had an excellent cup of coffee at the Red Hat office that I was at a couple of weeks ago, and it was called Salvador Dali. Salvador Dali, that was their name for it. And I had such great coffee at that office that I kept, it was a problem that I was having, that I kept every cup of coffee outdid the previous. And so I would have a cup of coffee and I would think, this is it. This is my coffee for this trip. Like, the whole week I'm going to drink nothing but this coffee. But then, of course, I would go to some other location and I wouldn't have access to that coffee. So then I'd try another one and say, oh my gosh, there's no reason to drink any other coffee than this. So this whole week, I will just have this coffee, but then I wouldn't be there. You know, it just went on and on like that. So the first one was at a Sheraton hotel, which I was not staying at, but I'd stayed at previously. So I knew that their coffee, the coffee at their downstairs little cafe, was really good. And there's this lady who mans the booth every morning, and she's super nice. And so I would go there, I would get the coffee, and it was delicious. Now, one day I went in and the lady wasn't there. And I thought, well, the coffee's probably not going to change, right? Boy, was I ever wrong. The coffee was completely different. So it was just this one lady whose name I forgot to get, but she's there. She's been there for the past 3 years. So I'm assuming I'll see her again. So she apparently makes great coffee, and it was great. But when she wasn't there, I after that first morning that she wasn't there, the next morning she wasn't there, so I went to another place called Tama, T-A-M-A, I think. It's a cafe. And they had fantastic coffee. Don't even know what they call it. It was just really good coffee. And then I went into the Red Hat office and had the Salvador Dali, and that was possibly even better. So it's really honestly a toss-up between those three. The whatever they were serving at Sheraton Hotel, whatever they're serving, made by that one lady, whatever they were made, they're serving at Tama, and then finally whatever they were serving, no, well, Solidarity Ali, that's what they're serving at the cafe. So those three coffees were excellent, and if you have a chance to try any of those three things based on the information I've just given you, you should definitely try them. Okay, so now we are going to overview time and tree. Such a mythical and mystical sounding task, but it's actually a lot easier than you might think. So time command runs another program, then displays information about the resources used by that program collected by the system while the program was running. I don't know if you've ever used time. It is very useful. I use it a lot when I'm running a command and then I'm walking away. A lot of times I'll do time just out of, I guess, curiosity, just kind of like, well, how long did that command run after I left? What happened between the time that I left and while the command was running? A lot of times that's something like DD or rsync or something like that, some kind of something that I expect to take a long time, but not always, and sometimes there's other reasons for needing to know the timestamp of something. But here's the catch. Remember how we were talking about TCSH versus Bash in the previous episode? Well, Bash has a built-in time command. So if you just type in time, for instance, so this is how you use time either way, really, but there's a catch here. So if we type in, for instance, time, and then space dd, space if equals dev u random of OF equals dev null status progress, then it launches a dummy DD process that copies bits from a random place, dev u random, to avoid dev null. And I control C out of that. Now it returns this output, real 10.94 seconds, user 0.094 seconds, sys 10.845 seconds. That seems to be exactly what time, that's the time, right? That gives you some time measures. Well, believe it or not, that's not the time command. It seems weird, but it's true. It's not the thing that you think it is, maybe. That's a built-in thing to bash. It's built-in time function of a bash. Decoded, all of that stuff means the real line is the actual, like, it's as if though you had a stopwatch. If you pressed start and then launch the command and then stop, when you pressed Control-C, that's the real time. User time is the amount of resources that the CPU used using outside of the kernel in order to accomplish this task. And then sys is the amount of CPU time spent in the kernel within the process. The only one I've ever needed in real life is the real time. I don't care what's going on underneath everything, what's taking up CPU time versus what's running in user space or user mode, whatever, I don't really care. So real time for me is all I actually need. And there are ways to filter it down to get just to the real time, but the only way I know to do that is to actually use the real time command, which is not just typing in time. That's a collision, actually. So you can do that. You can just type in time and then any command, and it will run the command, and then it will show you how much time is spent doing that command. That's a perfectly valid use for this function, but I'm telling you, if you are in Bash, then that's not the time application that we are talking about. If you have time installed, you can do a which time, and it tells you that where that is installed. And in my case, on Slackware, it's /usr/bin/time. So if I execute /user/bin/time, and then, for instance, I'm going to do a --format equals %e, which I happen to know means or refers to, give me a string formatted as the elapsed time. And then I'm going to do my dd command, if equals /dev/urandom. Outfile equals /dev/null, and then we'll keep doing the status equals progress because I really like that function. And I'll hit return, and I'll let it go for a moment or two, and then I'll press Control C, and now it tells me at the end of all of this, command terminated by signal 2, okay, great, 4.98 seconds. And that felt about 4.98 seconds, I would say. So that's the actual time command. And if you want to see what options are available to that command, you can do a man time, and you can see the different stream format options that you have, which are pretty useful. There's %E for elapsed time, which again, that's really all I care about. But if you want the other information, you could do a %S, which would be the equivalent of the sys output, which is the CPU seconds that the process spent in kernel mode, versus %U, which is the total number of CPU seconds that the process spent in user mode. You could also do %P for the percentage of the CPU that this job got, computed as %U plus %S divided by %E, %E being elapsed real time in hours, minutes, and seconds. The %e is elapsed real time in seconds only. And there are others. There are lots of other options. So the real time is a little bit more useful, I would say, if you really want to drill down into what's going on. You get averages, and I mean, really, you can go crazy with it. Like %p, the average size of the process's unshared stack space in kilobytes. I don't know what that means, but there you go. You can get that information using user bin time rather than the built-in function time. Okay, there you go. So that's time. Next up is tree. Tree is a really, really cool command. It is something that I keep meaning to use a lot more often. It is exactly what you might expect it to be if you expect it to be a list of a directory content, directory contents in a tree-like format. So if I cd to my home directory, just cd return should take me home, right? And then do tree. I get, wow, that's a lot. Shouldn't have done that. No, that's a bad place to do a tree command. We're going to downloads. There's not a whole lot there. So we'll do tree there. That's a lot better. And then it gives me all 43 directories, 1,308 files, with little lines drawn from one to the other, such that you can see kind of the hierarchy of the structure of that directory. You can control what's being listed a little bit, and how it's being listed. So there's tree-d for just directory listing. You can do tree dot lowercase p for the full path, printing the full path, and permissions. Actually, maybe that's permissions. Maybe it's capital P for the path. Speaking without looking at what's actually going on. No, there is no capital P. Okay. So, prints the full path is -F, sorry. So tree-F. Yeah, that's the full path. I don't know why you need half of these things, honestly. I think the killer feature of tree is the fact that it lists a directory and its contents with those pretty little lines drawn so that you see the inheritance right there visually in front of you. Because I don't really have a great handle on what people who say, oh, I'm a visual person, what they like need or prefer, I don't know if tree would actually be a really useful thing for people who like to see things sort of more visually represented. I honestly don't know. I would be interested in showing someone the tree command. I cannot, however, imagine like doing tree in home, your home directory. I mean, it's useless basically, because you get this you get a screenfuls and screenfuls and screenfuls. Because I mean, unlike, you know, if you just do an ls of a directory, depending on how you have things configured, you can have multiple columns, so you get it kind of all in a chunk of your terminal window. Whereas tree, there really is no equivalent to that. There's no way to make tree sort of collapse or diversify itself necessarily. I mean, it probably is. Like, if you really think about, like, okay, how could we restructure this such that the top level is centered, maybe, and then we could have multiple listings and columns underneath it, something like that. But I feel like that might get a lot more complex even just to look at, to be honest. So tree can be a little bit overwhelming if you're not using it with less, rather. So if I do a tree type less, Well, then that's great, because then you have like this little genealogical chart, of, okay, here's this folder, and within that folder there's this folder, and within that folder there are these files, and then after those files there's this folder. You get that, and it looks really, really nice. But it takes up a lot of space. It really does. It just goes on and on and on forever, because there's a lot of files on a system usually. But that said, Tree is really spiffy. It looks really cool. It's a nice little command to give you a visual representation of hierarchy, which sometimes gets lost. Well, it sometimes gets lost with LS, certainly, because there's not really a picture of hierarchy. There's a little bit of a workaround with LS dash capital R. I keep doing this in my home directory and then I regret it. Here we go. LS dash R, where it shows dash capital R, where it shows you the directory, the path of the directory, and then colon, and then it shows you in many columns, depending on how you have your terminal set up, and columns, lots of different file names. That seems pretty useful to me, but Tree can do that for you as well if you want it to, and it'll just print it in a long vertical line, which you may or may not be able to parse very easily. I mean, modern terminals have the scroll wheel. You can just kind of scroll back up and look through it. I can also imagine this as a great thing to redirect output, into a file. It's like, okay, I want a directory listing of this project, but if I just have a bunch of file names in a document, that doesn't do anything for me. But if I redirect the output of of Tree into a file and I can open it up, I get a pretty representation of the thing, and I can kind of scroll through, maybe delete the stuff that I don't want. I can see a sort of a quote unquote visual person doing that and quite liking it. So it strikes me as a very useful command, and it's one of those very useful commands that I never use. And I do mean to use it, but then I guess I must not be that type of person who needs the visual representation, I guess, because I don't default to it by any means. But that's Tree. Not a whole lot to say about it. Look at Man Tree for all the different options. It's a good one to know about anyway. It's one that I often forget about, and then when I rediscover it, I think, wow, I have Tree installed? That's great. Oh, it actually came with Slackware. That's nice. And that's it. Those are the that was for the T category within the A package set. That was tar, TCSH, time, and tree. We're through the T's now, and we can start the U category, the W, the X, and the Z, and we'll be done the A package set finally. This might actually happen in 2019. We may actually be able to move on to the AP package set, which is very exciting. Thank you for listening to the GNU World Order podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augencast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is at Klaatu at mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Coffee will be ready soon. We'll have a cup and drive in.